So the agency has a big budget problem. They've been trying to reach out to bird watchers, to hikers, to try and get more general fund money, essentially more general public tax money. But it's, you know, it's pretty hard to get an organization like Oregon Wild to go tell our members support, you know, taxes on hiking boots for ODFW because they're going to use it to persecute wolves. You're not going to get a lot of people in the conservation community cheering for you doing that. So I think this decision, you know, while on the one hand they want to get out of the controversy, on the other it's pretty short-sighted if your goal is to really have a stable funding base and, you know, a real base of public support going forward.
Yeah, I think more and more people are becoming more environmentally minded, so there you go.
Yeah, and I can say of the various things that I've worked on here at Oregon Wild, I've been here for about 12 years now. There's certainly a tremendous amount of public interest in wolves. You know, as much as some ranchers may view them as the symbol of what their granddads tamed and put to good use, I think there's an awful lot more people out there who really view them, you know, as essentially the symbol of freedom in the American wilderness. And, you know, if you're a backpacker or a rafter or a hiker or a mountain biker, someone who just enjoys getting out, you know, on Mount Hood or going to the Crater Lake, hearing a wolf howl in those places is a dream a lot of folks have. And I think in the long term, that's what people want to see again, is that we still have some pockets of wild left in Oregon. And, you know, the definition of a wild place is, you know, being able to look out over a place like Crater Lake and hear a wolf howl echo around the caldera.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, and thanks for the time.
I am Cliff Verla for KABU News.
You just got done listening to KABU's News in Depth. Stay tuned for Preference coming up at a little here in just a few moments. And you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and online at www.kabu.fm. Stay tuned.
KABU Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KABU.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KABU's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KABU members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KABU.
KABU Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge, secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons. It bankrupts schools and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KABU News Director Jenka Soderberg in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. And more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory. providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And we're one of the rotating shows in the Tuesday 6 p.m. Queer Life slot. Tonight we'll be listening to an interview I recorded this morning with Dean Spade. Welcome. We have Dean Spade with us here on Preference Radio tonight. Dean is an associate professor at Seattle University School of Law, where he teaches poverty law, administrative law, gender and law and social movements. In 2002, he founded the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. It's a nonprofit collective that provides free legal help to low-income folks and people of color who are trans, intersex, and or gender nonconforming, and it works to build trans resistance rooted in racial and economic justice. Dean is also the author of Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Limits of Law. And Dean is a solidarity activist, and we'll get to talk about that a little bit later. Dean, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dean, to start off, you're in Portland later this week. What's happening with that?
Yes. I'm coming to Portland to speak at Reed I think my talk at Reed is on Thursday at 5 o'clock.
And what's the subject?
I'm going to be talking, the folks on that campus told me they were particularly curious to talk about prison abolition and alternatives to punishment in prison as approaches to dealing with like violence and harm in our communities. So I'll just be talking a bit about those themes.
Wonderful. We'll come back to just those subjects a little bit later. I was talking with Sasha Buchert at the Transgender Law Center yesterday, and we were batting around some of these topics in prep for today's show. I want to start by asking you if there's anything else you want to tell us about who you are.
No, I think that you said some good things. Maybe other things will come out as we go.
Okay, great. So tell us about the Sylvia Rivera Law Project.
Yeah, so SRLP, like you said, is it's basically a poverty law organization, right? Like an organization that provides free legal help to people who are caught up in all these, you know, overlapping systems that target people of color and low-income people, people with disabilities. And basically, I started it in 2002 because I was aware that trans people are especially likely to be caught up in these systems and face like very specific forms of targeting in these systems. For example, a lot of these kinds of spaces are gender segregated or used gender segregation as a way of controlling people. So like homeless shelters are gender segregated, foster care group homes are gender segregated, prisons and jails are gender segregated, so many of these spaces. And in those spaces, trans people face both being placed according to birth gender and being highly targeted, especially with sexual violence and other forms of violence. So, that's kind of one area of, like, particular vulnerability. There's also a lot of vulnerability for trans people because folks are super marginalized from mainstream economies and from non-criminalized work. So a lot of people are living, like, really severely at the margins and often doing criminalized work to get by, which makes people highly likely to, you know, end up in these various systems. There's also issues of trans healthcare not being covered by a lot of different kinds of insurance and Medicaid in a lot of places. So there's sort of these overlapping issues that make trans people very much in need of social services and poverty law related services. But I was also seeing that people weren't getting the help they needed because a lot of the organizations and agencies that are supposed to serve people with these needs, even though those are already like incredibly underfunded, a lot of people aren't getting what they need. Also, those agencies were, totally unprepared to deal with trans people. And so I kept hearing stories of trans people having like their court-appointed attorney like tell them to find Jesus and not return their calls, or people being kicked out of shelters or not allowed to enter domestic violence shelters or drug treatment centers because those places thought trans people would be disruptive or didn't know how to place them or were just outright like didn't want them there. So the organization began as an attempt to address that, to kind of look at these poverty law issues, both providing direct poverty law service to people, like actually representing them in some of these situations, and also we do a lot of training of other agencies that that we'd like to see serving these populations better, and so we often like partner with lawyers or other providers to help folks through systems where maybe trans people would have been turned away for services or already had been. And then the other piece of it, obviously, is that our philosophy is that the problems of marginalized populations are not actually solved by just providing like these, legal services trying to fight these impossible systems in which you often lose even if you're, trying your best and actually have a lawyer. That's not the solution. That's kind of like trying to meet people right now where they are as best we can. But the solutions come from people building big movements and being, building power with other low-income people, people of color, immigrants, and other marginalized groups to try to change society so that nobody's poor and nobody's, considered illegal and nobody's in a cage. So the other piece of this is that SRLP is plugged into left movements and tries to help trans people be plugged into left movements and tries to articulate why trans politics should be part of and understood by left movements that are trying to end poverty in prison and borders. And so that's, an important part of this as well is mobilizing folks. And one of the things that I noticed is that a lot of movements that are providing vital survival services do that hand-in-hand with providing a space to be politicized and to become politically active. Like, it's hard to be politically active if you can't survive, and it's hard to be politically active if you're really marginalized in the movements that that you would naturally want to be a constituent of. And so we try to think about having our service. A lot of legal services are not a point of politicization. They're just a point where you either get, they say, yes, we can take your case, or no, we can't. And so we wanted to create a space where when you come for services in need, someone also says to you, hey, do you want to, this horrible thing is happening to you with your landlord or with immigration, like, do you want to get together with other folks who are having the same issues and try to, get to the grassroots, solutions to this? And then if folks want to, they can plug in. So it's a different theory of change than kind of typical poverty legal services operates on.
And the Sylvia Rivera Law Project is centered primarily in New York City, is that right?
Yeah, its offices are in New York City, and most of the people it serves are in that region.
Now, in normal life, you talk quite a bit about the dangerous trap of simply pursuing legal equality in our world as a too simplistic and dangerous strategy for marginalized folks. And you pursue a critical trans politics, encouraging the trans activists and their sense of social change to think much more broadly about how to serve the needs of folks who are marginalized or in danger. And there's the idea that mainstream queer politics has fallen into this trap of legal equality. And things have become very simplistic. It's about recognition. It's about achieving certain steps on the way to the rights of normative folks. Can you speak to us a bit about that?
Yeah. So, I think one of the big mythologies of the United States is that the problems that marginalized people experience can be resolved in law. So we're kind of told all these big stories in the U.S. I mean, I think the most central one we're told is a story about anti-black racism, that it was resolved by legal reforms. So the idea that slavery was resolved by the 13th Amendment, that Jim Crow and U.S. apartheid were resolved by, you know, civil rights laws. And I think that, you know, many of us have a deep understanding that something is very wrong with that story, right? The story that we're a post-racial society, or the story that, you know, gender oppression is no longer an issue because we have laws that say that you can't discriminate against women, or the same story about people with disabilities. I mean, this whole kind of story about how marginalized groups should turn to law will then recognize them. The state will, instead of being their oppressor, become their protector, and then those people will be equal. And if then they happen to still be doing the worst in society, well, it must just be because they're lazy or bad. You know, like, that's kind of the bottom line, of other side of that story. And so that story, you know, all kinds of left movements push back against that story. But part of what's important about it is that, you know, for those of us who are living right now, you know, the period when the U.S. started to really, you know, declare people equal and say that racism was illegal and ableism was illegal and sexism was illegal and all of these things, that period, you know, which is something like the last, you know, 40 or 50 years, that's also the period during which, like, material inequality has grown enormously. So during that same period, we've seen, like, you know, wages stagnate, more people working as temps or in the contingent labor force, less people have job security, less people are in a union, you know, the kind of growing wealth and wage gap that the Occupy movement made so visible with the 99% slogan, which is an incredibly racialized and gendered gap. And we've seen also the growth of the largest apparatuses of racialized violence, right? Like this massive prison boom, which is now getting a lot of attention. You know, we've seen immigration imprisonment quadruple since 2001. We've seen this, like, explosion of this privatized warfare system with, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and you know, on and on, and this kind of declaration of this endless war on terror. So it's a little bit iffy to be like, oh, we all became equal, because we've actually become so much less equal, and it starts to look like the declarations of equality are actually kind of papering over, or like a kind of false veneer for, you know, the ongoing explosion of inequality. So, you know, a lot of this analysis I get from reading a body of thinking called critical race theory, which is where people analyzed how the kind of supposed legal wins of the civil rights era have not turned into better access to school, housing, health care, and the material needs for black people. And, like, what is it that is tricky about those legal wins that sort of made them undermined or not do what people hoped they would do, or not do what they almost seem like they might do, right? How can our schools be so severely segregated today, you know, so many years after Brown versus Board of Education, and how can our schools at the same time be so deeply unequal so that kids of color still go to the schools that have the least dollars per pupil per year, and white kids still have more resources in their schools? So that whole, I say all of that to say that, you know, then we come to this time where we see the kind of rise of the mainstream lesbian and gay rights formation, and that formation seems to not notice that this is going on, and so then kind of pursue a strategy that primarily is about getting declarations of legal equality, which is just really questionable for those of us who understand the ways in which that has not delivered the goods, and has actually been kind of a false narrative for so many groups that have been supposedly declared equal. And so some of the classic things that are problems with that, you know, one is that the concern that it won't provide relief. Obviously, number one, when you have a movement, you want it to, the goal of it is to provide material changes in the lives of people who are experiencing harm or marginalization or poverty. And so obviously we want to fight for things that are going to, like, actually help our people. Like, that's number one. Another concern is that oftentimes when you fight for these kinds of equality pieces, or these, you know, include me in a existing institution like the military or marriage, when you fight for that, you often end up legitimizing that institution, which you know, movements have been trying to tear down or criticize, or even expanding it, right? So you've definitely seen with the lesbian and gay rights formation, the marriage and military are two institutions, like, you know, in extreme crisis. We've had, especially the movements in the 60s and 70s, really exposed both institutions as, you know, fundamentally harmful, racist sites of violence, and you know, longer than that, obviously, the movements against both of those are, you know, date to the times when each of them exist. But you see these institutions in crisis exposed as illegitimate. You know, you see marriage exposed as an unjust way to distribute immigration, healthcare, et cetera. You see a feminist movement that's really exposed it as a site that's been a, you know, that family violence as a real issue for in women's and children's lives, and you know, so much of feminist legal work was about making it easier to get out of marriages, which was a really huge set of victories, and really trying to move people towards greater the ability to be independent from those family ties and not be legally tied to them and stuck in them and noting them as a site of violence. So you see all of that, and then you see how the demand for quote unquote equality in for lesbian gay people in the military and marriage has really kind of rehabilitated those sites. It's kind of been like a propaganda for those institutions. It's like, oh, marriage is about love and family, when we've spent all this time being like, oh no, marriage is actually about racism and colonialism, and it's not about care, it's about forced unpaid labor, right? And you see the military lifted up as like a site of equality and a great job that gays and lesbians should be able to access, when all of our anti-war movements and our feminist movements and our anti-racist and anti-colonial movements have been showing that the U.S. military is terrible for the people in it. It's, you know, there's all this extreme sexual assault and racism inside the U.S. military, and people are traumatized by it, and vets are abandoned by the state. And then that obviously what the U.S. military does around the world is, you know, the bulk of the worst violence we can imagine. So so you see that danger of legitimizing those institutions. And then also as an example of the expansion of those institutions, people often look to hate crimes laws, right? Hate crimes laws are an example of the way that by claiming inclusion, we actually see the expansion of power of a harmful system. So hate crimes laws are statutes that will expand the penalty if someone is convicted of, you know, harming another on the basis of hate, so based on racism or transphobia or homophobia or whatever. And they also often come with increased financial resources to local law enforcement. So, you know, for those of us who understand that the marginalized communities of the United States are targeted by violence, primarily by the criminal punishment system, it does not make sense to expand the resources of that system when trying to deal with violence. If the number one sort of perpetrator of hate crimes against, for example, trans people in the U.S. is the criminal punishment system itself, police, corrections officers, et cetera, why would, you know, kind of putting more tools in the toolbox of that system help us, especially since there's no evidence that hate crimes laws prevent violence against us, and instead they provide more money and resources to that system. So that's sort of another danger. And then the third big danger, I think, of equality politics is that it divides groups between the deserving and the undeserving. So when people are seeking to portray a group as, like, deserving equality or deserving rights, it's usually done through portraying them through, like, the classic tropes of who's a deserving subject in the United States. So you start to see, you know, the tropes of whiteness, of able-bodiedness, of quote-unquote hardworkingness, you know, who is considered those who we think should be included into citizenship. And that's who gets kind of trotted out. And oftentimes the legal reforms that happen really only have something that will reach those people. Marriage is a good example, right? It's all about, you know, trotting out perfect, you know, families that look like what we've been told is an acceptable family, knowing that, of course, in our society there's all these incredibly stigmatized family formations and stigmatized people and people punished for having children and people portrayed as, you know, having too many children, all of that. So you trot out those people, and then, you know, the goal, of course, in marriage is to just get the benefits of marriage for people who can benefit from it. And mostly marriage is about sharing privileged statuses, right? So if you are undocumented and so is your date, you're not going to get any documentation. You're not going to get immigration status through marriage. Or if you don't have any health care and your date doesn't either, you're also not going to get health care through marriage. And if you don't have anything to inherit and they don't have anything to inherit, right, you're not going to get it. And most people date and marry inside their own class statuses. And overall, in the United States, poor people marry less because they have less to gain from it. So again, you kind of see this the structure where we end up both talking about who's deserving in ways that reify some of the worst, like, stereotypes and kind of controlling images that we'd want to not, you know, reify because they harm people in our communities. And also we just leave behind the people who are most vulnerable. And to me, what movements should do is serve those in the most dire situation first, right? Inevitably, that will benefit the whole group. But if you just serve the people who are kind of the least stigmatized and in the least dire situations, it does not reach the people who are, you know, in prisons and jails, facing deportation charges, living with disabilities, kind of in the most vulnerable situations. And so so for all those reasons, equality politics is really limiting. And when I wrote the book, I was kind of standing at this moment. I was mostly writing in 2008, 2009, and I was watching how trans politics was just beginning to kind of expand in mainstream. Like, there were suddenly more organizations that had funding, and there was beginning to be some, more visibility of the politics in the mainstream media, which now I think has, expanded much more. And I was like, I can see that we're at this crossroads. Like, we can choose this really limited politics that really centers white leadership, that really centers, strategies that are not going to actually reach the people who are facing the worst harms. And trans communities are, really experiencing these very severe harms of poverty and criminalization and immigration enforcement. And so if we choose these strategies, we're not going to be reaching, most people. And I wanted to say to folks, let's please pick another way. Let's have a trans politics and a trans practice that's critical and that centers those who are most vulnerable and that has a racial and economic justice understanding and that notices that there's lots of other areas of law that should be our focus instead of just trying to get these empty declarations of equality from the state. Why don't we actually ask, what is happening to trans people in homeless shelters? What is happening to trans people in criminal punishment systems? Maybe our legal strategies should be more centered on decriminalization or on reducing the power of immigration enforcement. And, of course, that whole politics also exists. There's kind of two tracks of trans politics, just like there's two tracks of lesbian and gay politics. And you see the one that's going to be on TV and it's going to be really highly funded and more visible. And then the other, the grassroots racial and economic justice version, that's also very vibrant but is not, does not make sense to the corporate media, does not get coverage. And so I was just trying to articulate that that choice that I think stands in front of trans politics and ask that we be influenced by the lessons learned from movements that have been failed by the legal equality strategy.
Thanks, Dean. The book is Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Limits of the Law. You're listening to Preference Radio, an experiment in queer radio here on KBOO. I'm your host, Alan. We're chatting with Dean Spade. Dean, thanks for being with us. I would love to shift the conversation and start to talk about solidarity with folks in Palestine and what that's beginning to look like in our part of the world. And I want to say up front that I'm Jewish, and for me, being Jewish it is a recognition that my faith is centered around being a minority culture, a minority ethnic group in some larger society, and navigating and negotiating what safety is in that kind of situation, which is a lot of Jewish history. But this that's something that I took out of my education and becoming a Jew right from the beginning. It goes back to when I was very little. However, this subject, Palestinian solidarity, is something that I've only begun to think about recently. I invited folks to come who work on this issue locally and wasn't able to bring anybody else into the conversation this morning, which is sad. A lot of this is fairly new to me, and I'm listening and I'm learning as much as I can. I want to start out by identifying a few things that are happening here in town. The first one that caught my eye is that Portland has a sister city relationship with Ashkelon, which was a Palestinian Arab city until 1948 when the Israeli army moved in and began to clear it and then constructed the idea of a city named Ashkelon over top of that. There's a sister city association here in town. They've gone so far as to co-host an event earlier this year with Christians United for Israel, which sets up a few flares for me. We also have a Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, which has agreed to help invite folks into a North American trip, North American-wide trip, through the Jewish Federation of North America, to visit Israel in the spring. And it's a visit where LGBT folks are invited to come to Israel on this specific guided tour for 1 week. It's tagged as See Israel with Pride. Folks who come along pay some good money, get to visit with queer entertainers, with the Israeli president, folks in the Israeli Defense Forces, and have this, you know, this structured tour through Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And then the third thing is that we have a Human Rights Commission that just last month voted to put several companies on the city's do not buy list for their for the city's investment. And these are four companies who are considered to be involved in human rights violations in Israel and Palestine. And there was some dialogue, some heated dialogue around that vote. A couple of folks in the commission changed their votes, but it still passed. And the mayor's announced that he won't honor it at all, that business will go on as usual. And so those are a few of the things that are happening here related to Israel and Palestine. And I know that you have been involved in, let's call it activities to bring light to how our region, how our municipalities are involved in Israel and Palestine.
Yeah.
And so that your work in that in Seattle leads to this film, Pinkwashing Exposed. So let's talk about pinkwashing.
Yeah. Yeah, so the idea of pinkwashing, it's a term that emerged to describe a particular campaign, kind of branding campaign that Israel's been involved in. So basically, you know, for about the last 10 years or more, there's been this movement. It's called the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, and it's been a movement modeled on the work done to oppose apartheid in South Africa. it's an international movement to have people boycott Israel and Israeli goods, and to have you know companies and campuses and investors divest from Israeli companies and companies that benefit from the occupation and apartheid in Israel, and it's a call for sanctions against Israel until they you know stop violating international law and subjecting Palestinian people to apartheid, and until they honor the right of return of Palestinian refugees. And so this movement has really, you know, it's been pretty significant, and it's drawn a lot of attention to the harms Palestinians face and to apartheid in Israel and the situation of colonialism. And as a response, Israel decided to rebrand itself, to try to work on its country brand. And so they launched a program called Brand Israel, which you can find lots of stuff about online, that is aimed at trying to help people think differently about what Israel is. So instead of, when they think of Israel, thinking about a kind of brutal site of warfare and colonialism, to instead try to think good things. And so there's an element that's trying to make people think of Israel as like a kind of green economy, and there's an element about like kind of innovative technology, and there's kind of this framework of seeing Israel as this, you know, modern democracy in the Middle East, kind of trying to juxtapose it and kind of with this Islamophobic and anti-Arab framing that, you know, the countries around it are so backward and it's so forward-thinking. And part of that is to say that Israel is this place that honors diversity. And a specific thread of that is to promote a public image of Israel as a gay-friendly country, a good place for gay tourists, and a place that is that, you know, cares about gay people. And so Israel has, the country of Israel has been putting money into this branding, and they've done that in a number of ways. They fund films that portray Israel as a gay-friendly place, and especially there's this particularly problematic theme of portraying it as a safe space for Palestinian queers to get away from their homophobic society. So it's kind of that classic trope that's been part of colonialism forever, of saying that, like, the colonized people are more backward around gender and sexuality, and that, you know, colonizer is more progressive. So it's that same trope, but this time played out as, you know, movies that portray, you know, Palestinian gay men who need to get away from their homophobic society and get into Israel and be safe. There's also, they also fund kind of panels and speakers who go around North America and Europe and talk about gay rights in Israel and talk about, you know, how gays can serve in the military in Israel and this kind of thing. And this whole, you know, framing is really smart. It's designed to try to get people who are progressive and left and make them associate a progressive and left issue like gay and trans politics with Israel. So it's a way to kind of try to scoop people who would have been aligned with an anti-colonial, anti-racist politics and redirect them. And it's just one part of Israel's pushback against the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, but and it's only one part of Israel's propaganda framing. But it's an important one that has been, I think, important in the U.S. because we have this equality politics I was just talking about that has kind of already prepped us to think, oh my God, gay people can serve in the military. That's so liberating. You know, that is kind of that's kind of prepped us to not ask more complicated questions. That's kind of divorced gay politics from anti-colonial or anti-military or anti-racist politics. And so that's part of why we're kind of we're seeing an audience that's ready to hear this, and people have to really often take a moment before they can see it as propaganda. It's an interesting, it's a very effective kind of propaganda for where the gay and lesbian rights formation has already put people's minds in a space that's pretty uncritical. So in Seattle, so in 2012, one of these pinkwashing delegations was coming to Seattle. So it was like a panel, you know, a group of lesbian gay rights activists from Israel coming to Seattle, sponsored by the Israeli consulate, a group called A Wider Bridge, which is based in the Bay Area and is entirely a pinkwashing organization, you know, running these same kinds of tours of LGBT people from the U.S. to Israel and promoting these pinkwashing movies and these pinkwashing tours, and also the group Stand With Us, which is, you know, one of the most kind of conservative, homophobic Israel advocacy organizations. So this tour was planned, and it was coming to the Northwest, and actually it was coming up all up and down the West Coast, but they had events, a bunch of events planned in Seattle, Olympia, Tacoma, et cetera, up here in my region. And the kind of headlining event was an event with the Seattle Lesbian and Gay Rights, LGBT Commission. So Seattle has commissions for a few different marginalized groups, and one of them is an LGBT commission. So it's a bunch of volunteers who serve on this commission. They're not elected officials, but they're appointed by the mayor to serve on this commission. And the commission, you know, does various things to look at questions of, that are of concern to LGBT people in Seattle. And so they were going to host kind of the headlining event of this, you know, Seattle region kind of tour. And a bunch of activists found out about this, and you know, were kind of right before it was going to happen, and went to the LGBT Commission's meeting that was the night before the event, and said, "Guess what? You know, this is propaganda." And people, it was mostly Jewish and Palestinian, queer and trans people who came to this meeting and said, "You guys, like, this is propaganda. Let us tell you our stories. Let us tell you what this really is." And the commission was horrified. They were like, you know, there were commissioners who cried. They were like, "We had no idea what we were hosting. We did not know what this was," because of course this is how this propaganda works. It's really effective for bringing people in. People just have no idea. They're like, "Oh great, an international event where we don't have to like pay any speakers. Like, this sounds really good. Let's do it. People will learn something," and have no idea that they're hosting propaganda. So the commission decided that night at their meeting to cancel the event, which was a pretty amazing victory for the activists. They'd gone, they'd told the truth, and they'd actually been heard by the people who are supposed to, you know, represent them in their city government. And then this huge backlash ensued where, you know, there was tons of media coverage, you know, criticizing the activists. There was, pushback from the city council. Ultimately, a city council hearing happened focused on it, at which people testified talking about how terrible and anti-Semitic this move was, and in which the commissioners were forced to apologize. So this is the kind of controversy I made this movie about, Pinkwashing Exposed, Seattle Fights Back, which I should say is free online, and anybody can screen it for free, and their campuses are in their communities. you know, the goal of the movie is to kind of help people understand what pinkwashing is and what these kind this kind of moment that happened in Seattle. You know, we're seeing this again and again. The tour you described that's happening in Portland is an example of pinkwashing. So a lot of times people are kind of becoming aware of pinkwashing, and the movie is just to help people learn to spot the propaganda and learn what the activism against pinkwashing looks like, which I think is a useful activist tool. And so the movie chronicles the activist victory and then the backlash, and then how the activists spun the backlash into further victories by, you know, continuing organizing here and in Seattle. This summer, the movie came out, and this around the same time, our gay mayor was planning his, you know, trip to Israel. It was a trade mission and a mission to go, you know, be part of this giant pinkwashing conference organized by a wider bridge that had, you know, speakers from the United States and Canada and the UK, et cetera. And so we also did a lot of protesting and asked him to cancel his trip, which he didn't cancel, but I think we brought a lot of attention to the question of Israeli apartheid and to the strategy of pinkwashing through that. And it's interesting that you bring up the sister city question, because Seattle also has a sister city in Israel called Be'er Sheva that we are beginning a project, a bunch of activists here, particularly folks from the Jewish Voice for Peace chapter, Sister Cities project, to really try to look at histories of displacement in Israel-Palestine and also in Seattle. So looking at where our Be'er Sheva Park is here in Seattle, and looking in general at the history of the displacement of Duwamish people, the displacement of low-income people and people of color through gentrification, and trying to understand the connections between forms of colonialism and displacement that have occurred here and forms that have occurred and are occurring in Palestine, Israel. So that's kind of another type of activism that I think is emerging in our region about this question, about these issues. But yeah, I hope the movie is a useful tool. I'm really interested in trying to have activist ideas not only be in print, but also be in forms that are easy for people to pick up and use in their communities. So that was the goal of the film, was to have it be a kind of a storytelling that would help people gain some of those tools.
Thanks, Dean. You are listening to Preference, a Queer Experiment in Radio here on KBOO. I'm your host, Alan, and we're chatting with Dean Spade about pinkwashing right now. The first thing that I did was start an online petition, knowing that they're hardly ever successful in any sense, asking City Council to withdraw from the Sister City Association relationship with Ashkelon. There's a few hundred signatures, so anybody who wants to can go out on the web and find that and decide if they want to sign it. Not so much because that's the one thing that's going to move things forward, but simply to have another voice added to the call for rethinking our silent acceptance of how Israel operates. And this brand Israel, this marketing that they do, these films and these film festivals that they support in the U.S., it is a PR, a propaganda campaign to settle us. And this trip, this See Israel with Pride, it's not cheap. It's not geared towards folks who don't, you know, who don't have a lot of money. And it's really meant, as far as I can tell, to make Israel seem like a jazzy, sexy, even romantic, and as you said, safe place for queer folks to travel to lay down a sense of, yeah, this is part of my world too. In that way that we are encouraged, I think, to be tourists and users of places that aren't our homes, but we can take advantage of, we're encouraged to travel and take advantage of them without real concern for what it's like for folks who live in and around those communities. That's some of what I think about when I hear something like these tours, See Israel with Pride. What about the rest of Israel? What about the rest of everyone affected by it? Those won't be part of the conversations. However, some of those conversations do exist. We're beginning to see rising Arab, Palestinian queer activism. I'm not much familiar with it, but I'm beginning to read up. Do you have a sense of that, of how that that vocalization is coming to the fore, Dean?
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess I'd say, like, part of the one of the things that was the most deepening of my work in this area was that I was invited to be part of a delegation of LGBT activists and scholars who went to Palestine at the invitation of activists, LGBT and queer activists there, who are part of the group Al-Khals and PQBDS, Palestinian Queers for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction. Those organizations hosted us there and brought us to meet various queer and trans activists in Palestine and various groups and kind of told us about what their work was and what their priorities were at the time. And it was really, powerful for me to kind of feel like I was getting my instructions on kind of what would be useful for me to go home and do as a queer trans activist in the U.S., how to do anti-pinkwashing work from where I lived. And then after we had that Seattle controversy that I just told you about, those folks then invited some of us from Seattle to join them at the World Social Forum that was focused on Free Palestine is it 2012 or 2013? I think, I'm sorry that I can't remember right now the year. I'm terrible at that. That happened in Porto Alegre, Brazil. And so we were part with them of a kind of track at that World Social Forum called Queer Visions. And so that, to me, I feel like that, all of this work is, the people who are the central leaders of this work are, obviously Palestinian people. That's who knows what the strategy should be. That's whose lead we follow. And in the context of the anti-pinkwashing work, it's been queer and trans Palestinian scholars and activists and organizations that have laid out this analysis of what pinkwashing is and what the strategies are that we need to take up against it and how we can work together. And they're in many ways often, kind of coordinating responses across various continents. And also Palestinian, Seattleites, queer Palestinian Seattleites, are key leaders of the work against pinkwashing here, and queer Palestinian people all over the U.S., I think, have been, the most important voices in articulating anti-pinkwashing activism. So I do think there's a very vibrant set of leaders doing that work and organizations kind of with very sophisticated and nuanced analyses of exactly how this propaganda is rolling out, what the counter moves are to the resistance that's been taken up by activists against pinkwashing. And I feel like very inspired by that work and very much like I've learned a great deal from those activists over the course of the last, 4 or 5 years that I've gotten a little deeper with them.
Right. And the aim here is for us as distant Americans, I guess, is to not allow Israel to dominate the conversation about queer rights in the Middle East in general, not to lay down this idea that Israel is the safe haven, everybody else is backwards, queers and any other society nearby are in danger, and that the West should look to Israel as the safety place for queers in the Middle East. And then second, at the same time, to hear from queer activists and queer lives in Palestine and in nearby countries, so that there is a multiplicity of viewpoints, and that it's not driven just by our own, our own sense of what we would guess to be the most appropriate way to move forward. So I think that's one of the most interesting things that I am seeing happening is these cross-national conversations, trips, folks going back and forth. I think there's great work to be done there.
I think also another key piece of the anti-pinkwashing critique is like there is homophobia and transphobia in every country. Like it is ridiculous and for Hillary Clinton to go on TV and make her speech about how gay rights are human rights and suggest that like we've kind of got this figured out in the U.S., but like she's gonna make sure that we can bomb other countries because they're homophobic. Like this whole kind of new justification for warfare in the same way that like the war in Afghanistan was justified by Barbara Bush as like a way of saving the women of Afghanistan. Like that whole framework, it's a very old trope, And one of the main things it ignores is, of course, like the brutal gender violence and targeted violence against queer and trans people that is like totally normal in the United States, like the concentration of queer and trans people in U.S. prisons, the torture and rape they face. Like, I mean, just like there's no, it's just, you know, that whole story that things are like good for queer and trans people in Israel or good for them in the United States and bad for them somewhere else. You know, we really have to interrogate that, because that who they're good for in the U.S. are like rich white gay people and like not that many other people besides that, right? So like, how can we kind of have a different understanding of the operations of racism and colonialism as happening in all these contexts, and see solidarity between all the kind of people who are suffering those violences in all of these spaces, instead of trying to like fall into these nationalist, you know, kind of rhetorics that that justify colonialism and warfare, that suggest that like some countries have like good policies for women and gays and other countries have bad ones, right? That's just like classic colonial propaganda.
If folks want to find out more what's happening in Portland, you can head out and look for Portland Jewish Voice for Peace and see what that group is up to. I want to change tack a little bit, Dean, and go back to the earlier part of our conversation. I want to ask you something that Sasha and I were discussing yesterday. We were looking at this lawsuit. Oh, yes. We were looking in particular at yesterday's New York Times editorial, Transgender Inmates at Risk, and a recent court ruling in California that's beginning to make gender-affirming surgery available to prisoners in California. The question Sasha and I were batting around, I guess, is how does a person resolve, you know, this tension of wanting to abolish prisons, you know, do away with prisons in their current carceral form, and at the same time work on initiatives like gender affirming surgery for prisoners. For people who are incarcerated.
I mean, there isn't really, to me, a tension. Pretty much all prison abolitionist work centrally believes in addressing and supporting supporting people who are in prison right now and working to address their concerns. The question is, when we take up that work, are we doing it in ways that might expand the prison system? Because typically, the way that the prison system has consistently expanded, and as you know, the U.S. has the largest prison system on Earth, the largest prison system that's ever existed on Earth, right? We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisons. So we have consistently expanded prisons in the name of making prisons better for prisoners. Like, that is one of the main ways we do it, right? Every time, I mean, right now they're trying to build a new youth jail in Seattle, and it's like, it'll be better for the youth. And it's like, you know, like the invention of women's prisons was because it'll be better for women to be in women's prisons. But then you had, like, an explosion of women's prisons, and now you have, like, a huge amount of women in prison. So prisons always expand in the name of making prisons better for the people in there. And so we have to be really thoughtful. So one of the ways that prison abolitionists think about this is, yes, we want to do direct work supporting people in prison right now. We don't want that to be a justification for expanding the prison system. So we always look at any particular reform or approach and figure out, is this going to expand the prison system or build more resources for the prison system? So, for example, you know, I've done a lot of work on trans imprisonment for years, and one of the things that people who are new to thinking about the issue often say to me is, well, should we be building trans prisons? I mean, is that the way to do? To make trans people safe in prison, let's build trans prisons. And, of course, the response is, no, if they build them, they fill them. We do not want to build trans prisons. We want to decarcerate trans people and everybody. And we want to support trans people right now to survive whatever they're going through in prison, but we don't want to be kind of suckered into supporting prison expansion that will further imprison our communities. And this is, you know, even in recent years in California, there was a whole push for, quote-unquote, gender-responsive prisons. Sounds good, right? Like, let's build prisons that'll be better for women was the idea, and they were going to have, you know, they were going to look less like prisons or something, or have curtains, or, you know, you could have your kids in them or whatever. And abolitionists said, no, this is just a way to build even more prison cells for women in California's giant prison system that already imprisons tons of women and who are subjected to horrible conditions. And so that's part of the way of thinking about it. Prison abolition isn't about not doing that kind of work focused on conditions. It's about doing it in a way that's smart and asking, will we regret later that we helped expand this system? And for, part of what that means is often, for me as a lawyer, is often doing work that's very much case by case instead of buying into like kind of large sweeping changes that frequently don't deliver relief. They look good on paper, but they often don't deliver relief, and then they often expand punishing power. So I think that, you know, the lawsuit you're talking about, the idea of having trans people have access to health care that's been denied is completely in line with something that I would suggest is a good approach and a good reform, because it's going to help people survive who are in there right now, and it's not building new prison cells. It's not right, like, it's a different approach than some of the ones that you hear about. But that's the kind of thinking we do. We ask, is this building bringing new resources or more resources to the criminal punishment system? You know, is anybody going to actually see relief? That's going to be a question, because most people who are in prison don't get the health care that they're already supposed to get. So there'll be a lot of battles even after California says it's going to provide the care, then still probably mostly won't provide the care unless we fight for it every single time. So we need to put that in place, make sure that there are people, you know, supporting individual prisoners, which is there's a huge lack of legal services for prisoners in the state of California.
I just have one last question today. Again, a similar slant. There's a new lawsuit by Dana Zim, who is asking the government to allow an option for gender that isn't male or female on passports. And this sounds like a classic example of seeking legal rights with perhaps the need for a broader context about what intersex means to be filled in around that in our conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I can say a few things about ID in general. So there's, you know, a lot of the work that I've been involved in for years is trying to make it less difficult to change your gender on your ID, because one of the big obstacles to trans survival is that is ID, and having ID that says who you say you are, and you know, one of the dilemmas is that all the different ID regimes all have different rules about if and when and how you can change your gender. So people often have different pieces of ID that say different things, and that can lead to problems because of the way that new war on terror practices compare pools of data in ways that didn't used to happen. So there's been a lot of activism around this. And the way that I think about it in general, like the big picture, is that I think it'd be great for us to ask why we have gender markers at all on lots of forms of ID, and whether they could be removed or reduced, right? So like in a practical way, like someone told me about one city that had bus passes that had gender markers on the bus pass, or that had a different, I think it had a different color bus pass that was like pink and blue or something ridiculous like that. Like, that's obviously, we can imagine we don't need that since all the other cities don't have that, right? So how can we think about, and then also people, you know, trans people would be stopped, and people, someone would say that's not really your bus pass because it's not the right color, you know, all of that, right? It becomes a site for policing individuals and creating obstacles to their survival. So one of my big questions is, why do we have gender on different pieces of ID? Could we take it off different pieces of ID? And in the meantime, while we're trying to figure out if we can get there, can we at least reduce the harms it does to people by reducing the difficulty of changing it if you need to change it? So having there be more options, like having there be an option to not have gender on your ID, I think is a fine option. My concern is if we have something third, I don't want it to be a site of policing. So I don't want to be forced to have a T on my ID, or have other trans people be forced to have a T on their ID, or have some other marker, or be forced to have a blank where everybody else has a gender marker, because that is going to expose people to more vulnerability, right? And most ID regimes are very non-voluntary like that. So I think that's the question, is can we, we're trying to move towards less harm of enforcement and less harm of surveillance regimes on people. And so to do that, we want to ask questions like that. Like, we don't want to just get a new category put in that's going to then be forced on people. But I do think that there are ways in which we could look at existing histories and stories about surveillance to think about this. So, for example, because one of the questions people ask me is, well, if you want to get gender off IDs, does that mean you want to have a gender-blind society and have, you know, nobody think about whether or not there's gender implications, like more people with certain genders are getting to go to medical school or something like that? And, of course, I actually really believe in affirmative action. I really believe in trying to notice if there are you know, populations that are not being served or remediations that need to be made. So my question is, could we think about it in terms of it being acceptable to collect data but not use it to target people? So, for example, this conversation has happened for a long time about HIV, the difference between HIV names reporting, so the idea that every time someone tests positive for HIV, their name is given to the state versus the idea of collecting aggregate data, like saying that, mm-hmm. you know, 400 people tested positive from Alameda County, you know, and not having to say, and maybe having demographic information so we can know who's affected, but not having their names. So it moves from being trying to track individuals to trying to track a social or health problem. Mm-hmm. And so that we might track, you know, we might use gender, although I think often gender is used as a proxy that's inappropriate, right? Like not everybody who has an F is has the capacity to get pregnant, but we often kind of make that a proxy. So that's, I mean, that's the kind of deeper level is how can we move away from policing gender through things like ID that really become obstacles to people working or getting on the bus or buying a beer or whatever it is they need to do with their ID or getting on a plane, but also not kind of have like a pretense of like a gender-blind society, which I don't think any of us think we're living in because obviously gendered discrimination and harm is, you know, widespread still.
Sure. Thanks so much, Dean. We have time for a last thought. Is your appearance in town this week open to the public?
I think it is. Yeah, I think anyone can just come to read on Wednesday at 5. I mean, Thursday at 5.
Right. And the subject is?
Prison abolition, transformative justice, thinking about ways of addressing harm not through criminal punishment systems.
Great, wonderful. Dean, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, take care.
Thanks, bye.
Today. I have a few announcements of events that are coming up. Planned Parenthood is in the area is expanding their services to trans folks, and they are having a focus group next Tuesday evening at their center on MLK Boulevard in Northeast Portland. If you'd like to participate in that focus group, please get in touch with them. On the 21st, an evening of Saturday, there's a Trans Liberation Now open mic night. You can reserve spots ahead of time. So please get in touch with In Other Words, and they'll link you to the organizers. Also, the Portland State Queer Resource Center is doing a series of events all month under the banner of Trans Empowerment, Resistance, and Resilience.